You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 16th, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everybody.
Do we have a special day today or something, Evan?
Well, the only thing I could find is that on this day in 1786, it was National Religious Freedom Day in the United States.
Well, that's something.
Yeah, it's something.
Isn't this the day that Prohibition went into effect?
I'll check on that.
That's your area of expertise, Rebecca, is it?
Well, my area is when it was repealed.
Right. Adolf Hitler moved into an underground bunker on this day in 1945. The rest is history.
Well, we got some new news items to talk about. We're going to start off with just a neat medical news item. Researchers create beating heart in the lab. This is one of those news items that I could have used as a science or fiction, except several listeners sent it in to everybody. So, no, but it was too much in the news. Everybody saw it.
Yeah,
so.
Way to ruin it, listeners.
It wasn't obscure enough.
Blame the listeners. Jeez.
This is kind of a new approach to creating artificial organs. And what they did was they took the hearts from pigs and rats. They did it with both types of animals. And they did a process called decellularization, which is essentially removing the cells from the whole organ.
Great word.
It is a great word. This is using a so-called cadaver heart, so from a dead animal. And then they injected them with a mixture of progenitor cells, which that came from a neonatal rat, if it was, you know, the rat heart cells.
What's a progenitor cell?
A progenitor cell is like a stem cell.
Like a stem cell, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so it's like a cell that can turn into other cells.
What was that neo-Nazi thing, Steve? What's happened?
Neonatal.
Oh,
neonatal.
Sorry.
Neonatal. Newborn. That means newborn.
Jawohl.
So then they seeded a decellularized heart scaffold, so like just the bare structure of the heart, with these heart cells. And then 8 days later,
you mean
the
with
heart
the
started pumping
with the stem cells? You mean they seeded with the stem
with
cells?
Yes, with these now these treated heart cells. So they have these heart cells that have been taken away from a cadaver heart, treated with progenitor cells, and I'm sure they did other things to it. And then they put it on top of a scaffolding like the shape of a heart, and then they connect it up with each other, and they set up shop, and 8 days later, they actually started pumping.
Wow.
So it actually grew valves and everything?
No, the valves were intact. The valves were intact, I believe. Things like that were intact.
They didn't get rid of them in the first place. Yeah,
right.
They were still there. So this is a possible way of engineering organs. It's a new approach. I don't know that this process is mature enough where you could actually start putting these things in people.
But
it's a first step.
Right, and it's a good first step. And it seemed to come out of nowhere for me, at least from the research I've done. I've never read anything like this. I do know that it's been classically a problem when trying to grow organs from scratch, that you know the vasculature is always tough because you need the vasculature there to transport nutrients to different parts of the organs. That's always been a problem, and this kind of gets around that. One downside, of course, is that you still need a heart to grow a heart. So it's not like you're growing it from scratch. You still kind of need the vasculature from another heart to grow the heart around. So
but it's got to be infinitely easier to pick up the structure of a heart as opposed to, you know, when you need to transplant a heart from a dying person into someone else. You know, I imagine there's a lot more that they would have to do to keep it on ice and to, I don't know, keep it beating. I'm not a cardiologist, but I'm guessing that it must be easier.
Well, a big plus with this scenario is rejection. Since 99% of the organ is going to be your cells, then rejection will be at the least be greatly reduced, if not totally eliminated. So that's a big plus with this process.
Yeah, I mean the technology of just surgically transplanting hearts is pretty mature and works really well. The big problem is rejection. That's what causes most of them to fail, is that just the body, the host rejects the donor heart or whatever the organ that's donated. And even in the best case scenario, it requires lifelong, pretty heavy-duty immunosuppressive drugs. So it's, you know, it's very difficult. Having something that where rejection is either not an issue or is much less of an issue and the need for medication would be much reduced would be a huge advance in organ transplant. The cool thing about the heart is that heart cells just sort of naturally, by the way they function, synchronize with each other and start beating in rhythm and sort of hook up with each other. So that's why this is so plausible. Although I would think that something like a liver or a pancreas would be a little bit easier because it really...
It doesn't have any real moving parts.
Yeah, it's just a clump of secreting cells. I mean, you would need the ducts and you would
right.
need those kind of things. So, you know, there is some structure that is necessary, but it seems like it would be easier to get some functionality
right.
out of just a clump of glandular
Plus,
tissue.
Plus, there's no electrical coordination. Wasn't there some concern over the stability of the electrical coordination of the... Of the heart.
Yeah, you might have to pace it, you know. But in that, when you transplant a heart, you cut all the nerves too. So that's already true of heart transplantation.
Okay.
Yeah. Now I don't know about the internal wiring in these hearts. I don't know if that may be an issue. When you transplant a heart, the internal wiring is all intact, but it's just not connected up to the regulatory wiring, the autonomic nerves that would ordinarily regulate heart function. Those are lost with heart transplantation. But that may be a problem.
Let's hope that they come up with a liver soon because, frankly, I never use my heart, but my liver gets exercised.
Quite the workout, yeah. That's
so,
what I hear.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't the kind of research that is going to lead to anything within the next 2 or 3 years, right? It sounds to me like this is the beginning of something that could take 10 years, 15 years.
Yeah, well, I think not necessarily. The earliest type of application may just be using this technology to seed heart cells into a heart that's failing to give it more pumping
yes.
power. So the heart is already there. It's already working.
Right.
The structures are already there. But a lot of the heart muscle has been damaged by heart attacks or whatever. And then you're just trying to bulk it up, but with more cells. This kind of technology may apply to that very quickly.
And that seemed like something even much more promising, even especially for the short term. Because, you know, the heart, the mm-hmm. rat heart that they created was only pumping at 2% of its capability. So, I mean, it's a great start. Great proof of concept, but this Band-Aid idea where you could take a dead section of heart that, say, a guy has a heart attack, you know, he could have a whole section of his heart that's dead and scar tissue. You could put this patch over it it's basically like a super Band-Aid that could potentially repair the heart and get rid of the scarring and just, you know, reseed the heart in that one area. That would be an immense boon. That would be potentially even better.
Yeah,
right.
why replace a failing heart when you
right.
could fix it? You know, it'd be
that's
a lot
awesome.
Easier. Now, that's not always an option. Sometimes there are problems that cannot be fixed that way. But certainly there's a lot of people to whom that would apply. So cool advance. The next news item is about divining rods or divination. And Rebecca, you blogged about this yesterday. Why don't you tell us about
that? I did. Well, a lot of people in the U.S. have probably heard the story about the missing Marine who was discovered murdered. Her body was found in the yard of the man suspected of killing her. She was going to testify against him, so he was the prime suspect. And the local sheriff in charge of the search for her body, gave a press conference, and one person asked if he did, in fact, find the body by divination. And he said, yeah, he did. He said that the rod helped them choose which of two possible burial sites to check in, and that it was the right one. So,
So it was 50-50.
Right, 50-50. They used a rod and magically found the right one. No. So, you know that everybody who believes in dowsing already is going to trump this as a success story, and the rest of us will shake our heads and try to teach them something about statistics. But it probably won't be heard.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently the guy was on Anderson Cooper, or someone was on Anderson Cooper repeating this, and Anderson Cooper sort of let it go without comment. Or so says Eric, who wrote us in about this piece. I've yet to see it, so I'm not sure yet. If so, it's kind of disappointing, because Anderson Cooper's the one who fought back against Sylvia Brown, and is very pro-Randy, pro-skeptical, so... Hopefully he fixes that or something.
Selectively, at least.
Yeah, these stories are so destructive. Yeah, just for a little bit more background, again, just using divining rods as a way of answering any yes or no question. You know, the rods move when you, one way if it's a yes answer, another way if it's a no answer. It's been shown numerous times to be worthless as, in terms of gaining any new information, and the movement of the rods is due to what we call the ideomotor effect, which is just very subtle, subconscious, you know, motor movements. When the person knows what answer they're supposed to get, they can make the rods move in the expected direction. But unfortunately, this is going to go down, as you say, it's going to go down in the history books as dowsing works. And the fact that it was just a 50-50 coin flip will be forgotten. And the fact that this is all just reporting bias, and of course, if it were negative, we never would have heard about it. So there, you know, I'm sure for every one of these that's 50-50 shots that's positive, there'll be another one that's negative. And
that's all we want to hear about, right?
Positive ones, right?
Well, that's all the news certainly wants to report.
The glass is half full, everyone.
Because a non-event is not news. The next news story, similar in that... it is another allegedly paranormal event that gets, you know, reported credulously in the media without the proper skeptical background, and it'll, you know, just creates this impression that something actually happened, and no, you know, the press doesn't dig deep enough to put the proper context to it. This one is another UFO sighting. This one in Texas, in a town called Stephenville. No relation.
You sure?
And. No, it's spelled with a PH, you know, archaic spelling of Stephen. Huh. So the story goes that there were a number of people in this small town that saw a very large, what they describe as a very large UFO that some describe it as being a mile across or a half a mile across, something along those
close
lines.
Close enough.
And, yeah, they give all the typical descriptions of it was hovering silently. It was very big.
Very fast.
It moved incredibly fast. But what they actually saw, now unfortunately there's no video to look at for this, at least none that I've dug up. You guys didn't dig up any video for this, did you?
No, I couldn't find anything.
What they actually saw were lights, right? They didn't see a ship. They didn't see anything. They saw just a series of lights. And they interpreted those series of lights as all being part of one large structure. And they kind of, and your brain, you know, will happily fill in visually, will fill in the gaps, you know. And this is a well established optical illusion where your brain does actually visually connect the dots. And if you think it's one object, it'll look like one object to you. But what they really saw was lights. I have a guess as to what this could have been. Certainly would be perfectly compatible with what they were describing. Any of you guys have a guess?
Well, some people. One person in the spot I saw was saying that it was. It was two airliners that were in the sky at the same time, and so all their lights,
right.
All their lights, kind of meshed together, and that's what they were seeing. So that was one you know alternative theory that I've seen thrown out there.
Yeah, that's one possibility is that it was multiple aircraft. The fact that the aircraft were quote unquote silent could have been due to the fact that they were just far away.
Right. Oh yeah.
Right, or it could have been due to the fact that they were something like ultralight aircraft, you know, something that wouldn't make a lot of noise. Also, as we've pointed out before, you against the sky, you can't judge size and distance and speed because you have no frame of reference. So what everyone thought was big and moving fast could have been just and far away, could have been close up, slow and small.
Right.
Well.
I love when they throw stuff out here like. One guy was saying the UFO sped away at more than 3,000 miles an hour.
They always try to calculate the speed.
And one guy,
one guy
who's a pilot, and he might have been the same guy that said that they are possibly from another universe.
I love that line.
Was a great line. Although I don't think this was the guy that looked at the UFO through the scope of a rifle, which I thought was. Whatever.
This is Texas.
It's Texas, okay. But this one guy said that it took a few seconds to cross a section of sky that takes him 20 minutes to fly in his Cessna. Now, of course, what patch of sky are you talking about? You can't tell how far away it is, as Steve was saying. And that is the common mistake that you see over and over and over again with phenomena like these. It's just, come on, people. You have no idea how far away it is, how big it is, and everything else is just pure speculation.
Bob, did you say that somebody looked at it through the scope of a rifle, like
yeah,
with the rifle? That there's a UFO, you know, like what? What the hell is that?
Well, yeah, if you had one on hand, I guess that you would use
right,
it.
But
I mean, it's a scope is a scope.
Oh my god!
The one thing that occurs to me is that if there are estimates that this is a half a mile to a mile wide, if that were accurate, I think it would have been seen by many more people than this sort of very localized area of people that,
that's true.
That saw it.
40.
That's something that would be visible for, you know, miles and miles right. around, right? I mean, that'd be that's we're talking about something like on Independence Day, right? I mean, like that.
Yeah,
movie.
Somewhat.
Sadly,
those
yes.
things were like 15 miles across.
Yeah, I mean,
or
a spaceship
yeah.
a mile across. That's what we're talking about. Also, a half a mile or mile across object
and
that's
silent
hovering,
would flatten, it'd kill everything in sight.
Right, it would flatten everything beneath
the pressure.
It.
Yeah,
it would have to be producing some kind of thrust or something.
Unless
to,
it was
to
held up,
it up
by strings.
There you go.
Remember, it was
or silent. Maybe it was tied
didn't
to
make
the moon.
A sound.
Did anybody consider that?
Exotic yeah. alien technology that breaks the laws of physics.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I was going to say, you have to postulate really exotic technology that you know breaks the laws of physics in ways we can't imagine. So that's it's just, you know, you have on the one hand a highly implausible story, or on the other hand, people saw a bunch of lights and misinterpreted it. Which I think is the more likely explanation. All right, the next story is a follow-up of sorts. A recent study that was published a couple weeks ago looked at the rates of autism reported in the California system, and they found that the new diagnoses or new referrals for autism have been increasing, and that they've been increasing at a steady rate, even after the removal of thimerosal, which is a mercury-based preservative, from the childhood vaccine schedule. Now, this is very significant because there are still many people out there, many groups, that claim that thimerosal in childhood vaccines causes autism and was the cause of this apparent increase in the number of new autism diagnoses. Of course, the evidence, and I've written about this multiple times, the evidence shows that there isn't a real increase in autism. It's just increased surveillance and increasing the scope of the diagnosis. The evidence clearly shows that it's not linked to vaccines. It's not linked to thimerosal. And this was, you know, the one of the final tests, you know, that many people have been waiting for. Because if you think A causes B, right, and they're saying, well, vaccines caused autism, and as the vaccine schedule increased, autism increased. And actually, they used this California database to make their original case. And they said, well, if that's true, and everyone agreed with this, if that's true, then once you remove thimerosal, which was done pretty thoroughly by the end of 2002, then autism rates should start to decrease, right? You're removing the cause, so the autism rates should come down. So those who believe that thimerosal causes autism, you know, predicted it would the autism rates in California would come down by 2007, and this they haven't. But this was like the first formal study looking at it officially, saying nope, they continue to rise unabated. So this is another nail in the coffin of the vaccines or thimerosal causes autism hypothesis. Now, the interesting thing about this is the spin that the vaccine critics, the anti-vaccinationists, are putting on this data. And there's you knew that they were going to, they weren't just saying, oh, I guess we were wrong. The data shows that our ideas were wrong. Well,
if that ever happened, I'd have a heart attack.
Right.
Does it ever happen? I don't think it ever happens.
It's rare. Oh. I mean, so what they're saying is, I mean, some of them are starting to say that even the most hardened anti-vaccination kooks have to admit that thimerosal, that their original claim that thimerosal was primarily responsible for the autism epidemic, which again is not a real epidemic, it isn't the explanation. So they're saying, well, it must be other stuff in vaccines. So there's still, I mean, again, it's really, this is all about the vaccines. So it's got to be other things that are in vaccines that are doing it. So that's one of their strategies, is to say that. But this one comes from Vaccine Awakening. This is a blog. It's, again, just an anti-vaccinationist blog. And the author is Barbara Lowe Fisher. And this is just incredible. She, her point is that the percentage rate of increase in autism has been leveling off, has been decreasing. Even though the absolute numbers have been increasing, that the percentage rate of increase has been decreasing, and that's due to the removal of thimerosal. And that is just such blatant stupidity that, you know, you have to wonder, does she really believe that, in which case she's an idiot, or is she just completely abandoned any intellectual integrity whatsoever?
All of the above.
Yeah, or some combination of those two. So imagine, if you will, what she's talking about. The rate of autism has been increasing roughly linearly, right? Now, if you take any linear increase, as the absolute numbers increase, the percentage of the increase will decrease,
right?
That's just this is just math. So like, if you have something that goes from 1 to 2, that's 100% increase. Then from 2 to 3, that's a 50% increase, right? Then from 3 to 4, that's a 33% increase, right? So even though it's increasing at a linear steady rate, of course the percentage increase is going down because the absolute, the denominator is going up. The absolute number that you're starting with is going up. So that's what she's talking about. You know, the rate of increase has been steady. And if anything, has been increasing. And she's just playing with this really simplistic misinterpretation of the math in order to argue that the data supports a role for thimerosal in causing autism, let alone the insanity of saying that, you know, the rate of increase would be decreasing. If they're even partly right, you know, autism rates should have plummeted after thimerosal was removed from the vaccine schedule. So it really is just incredible. I mean, I knew that they were going to have ridiculously stupid responses, but that was even more
you know, stupider than you thought.
I think
this
be.
Woman owned a Barbie doll in the 50s, you know, the one that said when you pulled the string, math is hard. And I think that influenced her early in life.
That was Malibu Stacy,
so?
Not Barbie.
Oh.
Yeah,
wasn't it Barbie?
Malibu Stacy.
Wasn't there a Barbie doll that said math is hard?
Are you kidding? No, it's Malibu Stacy.
Well, in any case.
You're joking, right? You don't know that?
I think that's a fictional copywritten character from another
show that you're quoting. That's what it's from. Math is hard.
No, I'm not kidding. There was a Barbie doll way back when pull string Barbie.
Wasn't that
one of the things she said? Was math is hard.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes, that's where the Simpsons took it from.
No, there was not
from.
A Barbie that said math is
but that's
hard.
A real int. I believe there is. I'll look that up now.
One more ridiculous response. This one comes from Safe Minds, which is another anti-vaccinationist group. And their analysis is equally absurd. First of all, they find any way they can to criticize the data. Of course, this is the same data. This is what's so delicious about this. This is the same data they were using to support a connection. And now that it goes against their ways, they're saying, oh, there's problems with this data. But here's what they say. If other compounds act on the same pathways leading to autism, and exposure to these other compounds is increasing while thimerosal exposure is decreasing, then a decrease from thimerosal removal would not be detected in an imprecise prevalence trend because the other increasing substances would cancel out the decline. So there you go. So there are other things that cause autism in the same way that mercury and thimerosal does magically, and that they've been increasing in precisely the right amount to completely obscure any effect of abruptly yanking thimerosal from the childhood vaccine.
I thought it would be hard to match that
totally
ridiculous statement, Steve, but you did it. Wow.
Yeah, right. That's the level, that's the intellectual level that we're dealing with the anti-vaccinationists. They're like creationists. You know, they're creationists for vaccines. That's what
I have an update on this for you guys. So it was July 1992 when Mattel released Teen Talk Barbie, in which she said over 270 phrases, one of which was, math class is tough.
Well, you were wrong.
There you go.
Evan, can you,
Teen
can
Talk
you say
Barbie.
It like the doll would say it?
Math class is tough.
No, not you, Rebecca. Evan, you said
I was about to say, this sounds exactly like when Evan tries to do me.
That'll be the only time in my life I ever try to sound like a Barbie doll.
As far as we know.
Except for
One more news item. Jay, this one is for you. Tommy Boy. has a new video out. Won't you? Can you tell us about it?
The quick backstory is I had heard about it, and I guess the video actually came out in 04 when Tom Cruise was accepting an award that he won, like the Freedom Medal Award that Scientology gave him. So this was his acceptance speech.
Did he jump up and down on the couch? Or
no, he was actually, you know, quite calm, sitting in sitting in a nice like office looking type of living room area or whatever. You know, the 1-2 is that this is an edited version of a much longer acceptance speech that he gave. Or, you know, this information is all like given by an ex Scientologist, and you know, it's not 100% confirmed, but this is what's going around on the web. You know, it's just really another nail in the coffin of just how bizarre and deeply entrenched he is into the dogma of Scientology and how lost he is. A couple of interesting things that happen in the video are, like one quote, I did blog about it, but I'll just read one quote out of the ones I quoted today. Tom said, "We are the authorities on getting people off drugs. We are the authorities on the mind. We are the authorities on improving conditions. Criminal, we can rehabilitate criminals. Way to happiness. We can bring peace, unite cultures. If you are a Scientologist, you see life, you see things the way they are, in all its glory, all of its complexity, and the more you know as a Scientologist, you don't become overwhelmed by it."
Dear God.
Yeah, it's just incredible. I mean, the thing that struck me about that is that, yeah, you know, he thinks they're the experts on the mind. It's like, nah, you can't just make up a bunch of crap and then have faith in that crap and call yourselves experts. We know what's really going on because I just made up a whole bunch of stuff about it. That's basically what they're saying.
Yeah, it's not like Scientologists are performing research and
wow,
drawing legitimate conclusions. They're just making up rules and facts, and that's it, and they preach it.
Isn't that L. Ron Hubbard in a nutshell, kind of?
Bet his friends that he could make up a religion.
Sold it.
Followed through, won the bet. It's amazing that people actually take it seriously. Except for I'm really starting to believe that there's something to that whole, like, space aliens came down and possessed us, because Tom Cruise is a friggin' alien. The guy is from another... I think maybe he's from another universe.
Well, lasers come out of his eyes, right? I saw that. I saw
just
that
like
video.
There's UFOs.
This rounds off my summation of Tom Cruise in a way. Like this gives me like the final piece of information, even though this did happen, you know, years ago.
Oh, are you holding out some kind of hope, Jay, that this person...
No. I mean, what I'm getting
qualities?
At is I've seen enough now, like all of a sudden it clicked in my brain. Like, he is jubilant about Scientology. The guy is extremely happy. He loves it. He really is living,
yeah,
that thing that you see him doing. Like, he is really happy. He's excited about it. He really does want to help people. But the sad thing is, from my perspective, he's such a blatantly lost soul. He has no idea where he is.
Yeah. It's clear from, you know, the kind of stuff that he says in the video that he believes in magic. You know, it's like he thinks he's got... They really do think they have these magical powers. You know, it's like you see somebody who has got into an accident on the side of the road, and we have to go help them because Scientologists, yeah, are the only ones who can help.
Well, they're all superheroes,
they
right?
Solidity Man.
They're the only ones with the superpowers to do
the molecular man.
Self-validation.
I actually kind of feel sorry for him now. Like, I just don't hate him like I used to. Like, it's pathetic.
He needs
help. Like, these people need help. This is really scary.
I was also sad to learn today that Will Smith is a Scientologist and is getting on the whole proselytizing bandwagon.
Too bad.
He pissed off some of his co-workers, some of the people working on a recent film of his, because I guess big stars are supposed to give gifts to the crew after a movie, and his gift to the crew was a gift card granting them a free personality profile at the nearest Scientology
center. It's worse
center.
Than a
fruitcake. It's already free.
Wait, that is a fruitcake. What am I saying? That kills me. I love Will Smith. I never liked Tom Cruise. But Will Smith, that was my first cassette tape, was Parents Just Don't Understand, DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. This kills me. I adored the Fresh Prince.
I totally agree.
And to a lesser
you.
Extent, Will Smith.
I had, even though so I don't think he's an amazingly brilliant actor, like mind-numbingly fantastic, like he's kind of like an Arnold Schwarzenegger type actor to me. Like, he's got fantastic charisma, and I'm drawn right in, and I love him, and I'm really depressed about this. It's a shocker.
Yeah. He's never steered me wrong before.
It stinks. Well, we still have Dean Cameron.
You know, and this goes right in line with me saying, I don't want to know what these people think. I don't want to know their personal lives.
Yeah.
I just don't care.
Yeah. Well, part of it is that, you know, the whole bit of acting is to create this illusion, you know, that you're a cool guy or a heroic guy or whatever. The things that we really like about these people,
look,
really
that's not
just
true.
An illusion that they're creating.
Yeah, they're professional
Will Smith
fakes.
Is red. Man.
No, he's really
he's
cool.
He's down with it.
And it doesn't, you know, it stinks in kind of a, you know, like a child being told that Santa doesn't exist kind of way, that they aren't the cool people that, you know, we imagine they are. They, in this case, they're really just a couple of
definitely.
Deluded.
Oh, but just
know,
for all the listeners
dorks.
Out there who might be wondering, we are all actually as cool as you think we are.
No, we're actually
we're
far
way cooler. Oh,
the podcast is cannot really convey the totality of our coolness.
We tone it down for the show, definitely.
Yeah. In real life, these guys don't actually wear fanny packs. They just, that's an act they put on.
That's right. Now, don't give him a peek behind the curtain.
It's
Rebecca.
Depressing, though, when you actually think of Will Smith buying it hook, line, and sinker to the point where he's, trying to spread it to other people. It really is depressing.
Yeah.
Well, let's struggle on. Let's move on to some of your email and questions. Just one email this week. This one comes from Paul
Desarmaux.
Sorry if I mispronounced that name. From Rochester, New York. And he writes, SGU gang, although it's possible I may be overlooking a simple explanation, I'm not quite sure how an asteroid and or volcanic activity killed off the dinosaurs without destroying almost every other existing species living at the same time. If the theory is correct that it was the resulting dust and smoke that blocked out the sun for years and years, which in turn would have killed off plant life, why didn't all living creatures, except bacteria, of course, go the way of the dino? This doesn't seem logical, although, again, I may be missing a simple explanation. Help and thanks.
Well, Paul, it's very easy to answer. Basically, the smaller mammals lived inside the carcasses of the dinosaurs and fed on them for, you know, about 100 years. And that's how they survived.
We call that Jay's dinosaur carcass theory. Now, seriously, first of some basic facts, just for background. We're talking about the KT extinction, which occurred 65 million years ago. And the prevailing hypothesis is that this was due primarily, if not entirely, due to an asteroid strike in the Yucatan Peninsula. Paul, when you say that such an event should have wiped out almost all life on Earth, well, actually, that's what happened. We kind of talk about that as the dinosaur extinction because dinosaurs are cool and everybody knows them. But 85% of all species alive on Earth at that time went extinct. 85%. That's actually not the biggest extinction that the Earth has had, but that's pretty big. Not only did all dinosaurs go extinct, but all plesiosaurs and mosasaurs, both of which are large swimming reptiles, all pterosaurs, like a pterodactyl. Some people mistakenly think that they are dinosaurs, but they are not. They were a different order of reptiles. The ammonoids went extinct. Those are curled up like aquatic predators. Ammonites are like these cool fossils you can usually find in fossil stores these days because there's tons of them. Belemnoids, which are squid-like animals, went extinct. Most reef species went extinct. And pretty much every animal species over 55 pounds went extinct. So there was a weight factor. The smaller animals were able to survive better. And if you think about it, if all plant life was wiped out, obviously it wasn't completely wiped out, but even if plants were not growing leaves and producing energy for a while, there would still be a lot of seeds and roots and whatnot around.
Yeah.
And so animals that lived off of that kind of stuff and were small enough survived until the plants, you know, recovered.
And that points to one of the problems with the premise of the question, I think, is he says here that the sun was smoke that blocked out the sun for years, and from what I could tell, that's a false premise. The couple sites that I went to, one was the World Book website, another one was a NASA website. They both said that the sun was completely blocked for many months, and that's a huge difference because I think if it was many years, that could have been it for even more species.
The end of everything. Yeah.
But from what the World Book website said, that small mammals and birds survived because they were protected from the cold by fur or feathers. Mammals and birds could also feed entirely on seeds, nuts, and rotting vegetation. Other survivors may have escaped extinction because they would live at the bottom of the lakes or a burrow underground. And so for months, that could be done for months. For years, I don't think that could be done for years. So one of the keys is the fact that it wasn't for years. And luckily, it wasn't.
And I think the other thing is that it's a lot worse than people think. It wasn't just this isolated group. The dinosaurs were not especially susceptible to it. It's just that you wipe out 85% of everything. A lot of groups are going to go extinct just by chance alone.
And Steve, some percentages that I got, I'm not sure what your source was, but one that NASA site said that 60 to 70% of all other species besides dinosaurs went extinct, and ocean species were hit harder. Ironically, they're saying 90% of them becoming extinct.
Yeah, that's what, when I said reef animals, those are ocean reef.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, most ocean reef
species.
You
didn't mean potheads.
And plants, actually, also. Right.
Is that what you meant?
Keep in mind, though, that as nasty as that event was, it wasn't the mother of all extinctions, which happened about a quarter of a billion years ago at the Permian extinction. Mm-hmm. That was the granddaddy.
What
of all
did that one? Bob?
That's where was that?
Not clear.
Yeah, that's not nearly as clear as the KT extinction.
Might have been a supervolcano, like the Siberian supervolcano. I think is in play for that one. They may still be looking for like an impact that could explain that. But that was, if I recall, 95% of all species on Earth went extinct with the Permian.
Yeah, one article 95%. I read, the article was an attention grabber. It said, the day the Earth nearly died.
Wow. Yeah. Imagine that.
And don't feel bad about it, because if those extinctions didn't happen, we wouldn't be here.
That's right.
Yeah, well, I don't stay up at night worrying about it, Jay.
That's good.
Well, let's go on to our interview. Joining us now is Brian Dunning. Brian, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And Brian, for those of you who don't know, is a fellow science podcaster. He puts out the weekly science podcast Skeptoid, which is an excellent podcast. And Brian, since I've been listening to that, there's one question that has been nagging at me that I've wanted to ask you. And
uh-oh.
That is that your eye in the logo?
Yes, it is. And do you know the meaning of the eye? Nobody ever gets that. I thought it would be obvious, and nobody ever figures it out.
Is it a derivative of Stanley Kubrick or something else?
No, it's just the skeptical eye. I say in many episodes, let's point our skeptical eye at this. Let's point our skeptical eye at homeopathy, whatever it is. And nobody's ever picked that up, so I guess it was lost.
Okay, that is the skeptical eye. Well, it's good to have little mysteries for your listeners to figure out. So, Brian, how did you get into the whole podcasting thing?
Well, I think like many of us did. I'm someone who was basically sort of a closet skeptic my entire life. I never really had any belief in any sort of paranormal stuff, supernatural stuff, and so on. But I never really knew that it was, a real thing, that there was like a community out there, and there's conferences, and there's podcasts, and there's books, and there's people who do this kind of thing professionally. And somehow I just kind of drifted into it. I think I was just kind of randomly searching the internet for James Randi or something like that one day. Of course, Randi has been one of my favorite guys my entire life, and came upon the JREF website and found Skepticality, listened to a couple of Skepticality episodes, and thought, boy, I would totally want to do that. It just seemed so cool to me. It was exactly what I wanted to do. So what I figured is I'd sit down and do three or four of them and get it out of my system, and that was going to be the end of it. I honestly believed that.
Is that right?
So you're still getting it out of your system, huh?
I'm still getting it out of my system. It's like one of those big mucoid plaque. There's a lot to get out of the system there.
You got addicted to it? All the fame and women?
The fame and women. It's been working out wonderfully. You guys all know, I'm sure.
Yeah, right. And then the money, of course.
Oh.
Wait, I haven't got any women.
That's not what I've heard.
We'll throw you some spares.
The corporate paymasters are just great with the money, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, shilling for the man is good work.
Indeed.
So, yeah, the subtitle to your podcast is Critical Analysis of Pop Phenomena, and you cover, all of the typical skeptical topics. Just reading from some of your previous episodes, the Roswell incident, which I thought was actually a very good episode, medical myths in popular culture, are microwaved foods poisonous? The topics are pretty self-contained, and I think a good length for just sort of a one-topic podcast. So what made you decide upon that format?
I think that it was what I liked listening to when I first started doing this. I listened to all that I could find, which was really only three or four. I mean, I was brand new to this. I didn't know anyone in the community. I didn't know really what podcasts there were. So I grabbed the few that I could find, and I found that I was tired of listening to intro music and all kinds of things in some of the podcasts. And so I just decided I'm just going to do this. It's going to be 5 minutes. Let's get immediately into content, in and out, no wasted time, not a single wasted breath. And that's just kind of the format that I settled on and stuck with, and I get positive feedback on it. Sometimes I get negative feedback, but most of it's positive.
Now, Brian, what's your day job? What do you do for work?
I'm a software venture consultant. I work with people in small business, usually, who have an idea for a software product in their industry, and I work with them, if it's a good idea, I work with them to turn it into a real software company, kind of participating at whatever level their product requires.
And so your interest in science has always been purely just as a layperson, just for interest?
Yeah, very much. I don't really have any involvement with science in my profession. You can't really call software development a science. Certainly, it's an art at best.
Right. So you're like Bob, whose day job is software, but is certainly a science enthusiast.
I put on the mask and the cape at night.
And the cape. Took the words right out of my mouth.
Right.
Brian, so could you... How do you prepare for an episode? Can you give me kind of, you have like a template you go through of research, or do you have, depending, I guess, on your familiarity, but what do you do to prepare for a podcast?
Well, you know, each podcast of mine sits in a folder for weeks and weeks, getting worked on little by little. I'm always working on a number of them. I always have a folder of ones that are written and ready to go. And I try and finish two of them per week, which I never quite make it, and that's okay because I only need to record one per week. So, yeah, people send me ideas. I mean, people send me ideas far faster than I'll ever be able to catch up with, which is great. I'm not complaining. Keep them coming. There's no danger of running out of material anytime soon. I just work on them. I usually spend an hour in the morning every day working on writing and researching the episodes, and then Tuesday mornings I sit down and record them and post it.
Now, before we talk about some specific episodes, actually, I wanted to mention that you are going to be one of the speakers at TAM 5.5, which is coming up in just a couple of weeks.
Yes.
Do you know your topic yet?
I'm not sure. I know that they're going to have me speaking on a couple of panels, I believe, on Saturday, the main day of the conference. And I also have a five-minute talk scheduled. I was thrilled to get 5 minutes. perhaps most significantly, on Friday, I'm going to be joining Rebecca and Bart Farkas on the, what are they calling that, Rebecca? The special event or special extra super duper?
I think they're calling it the super special awesome rad podcasting seminar.
Yeah. So we're going to be doing that on Friday.
I think that's how many adjectives. Yes.
That's the correct name.
So, yeah, if anybody listening wants to know even more about how Brian makes his podcast or about how we do the Skeptics Guide, definitely come to the seminar. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I was actually talking to Randy today. He said that they have a few more seats to fill at TAM 5.5. So if you can be in the area. What's the exact date, Rebecca?
Friday the 25th. So, yeah, very soon. You've got about a week.
And I'll just throw in my voice. Last year's The Amazing Meeting in Las Vegas, it was TAM 5, yeah. That was my first one, and I was absolutely floored by the event. It was so much more than I expected.
Wasn't it great?
It was just incredible. I can't encourage anyone strongly enough to, even if you're considering going, don't miss it. Don't let the chance go by.
Yeah, TAM 5.5 just about 10 days is going to just whet your appetite. TAM 6, I'm hearing some super secret stuff about it that I can't tell anybody, but it's going to be an excellent event. We're all going to be there
when this is over.
So make your plans. Make your plans now. So, Brian, actually, one of the recent episodes you did that which I thought was very informative was one where you discuss creationists, what they really believe.
Various forms of creationism, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
You know, I found that for some reason, just as a bit of a backstory, for some reason the episodes that I do that involve Christianity or creation or evolution are always the most popular. That's not necessarily what I was going for, but that's the ones that always get the most attention. And oftentimes I will speak at university skeptical clubs, secular clubs. I'm actually speaking at a church next month, which is going to be interesting. But one thing that I've found is that many people who are creationists have never really sat down to nail down exactly what type of creationist they are. Many of them simply leave it at, you know, it's enough that God did it and it doesn't matter how. Well, if it doesn't matter how, then why are you so strongly against evolution? What's the problem if it doesn't matter? So clearly it does matter to them. And so I sat down to make this episode that delineates basically seven common types of creationists that are very distinct from each other and mutually exclusive. You can't have this belief and that belief from this competing theory of creationism. So this one was basically just an introduction to how it's possible to be a person of faith and still fully accept geology, fully accept evolution, biology. There are perfectly valid ways of doing that. For example, the Catholic Church, their officially stated position is they accept evolution, they accept geology, the age of the Earth at 4.5 billion years, and that these were simply the tools that God used as creation.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, in fact, it's what they call the big tent, right? It's like all creationism under one common tent. And the only thing that really ties them all together is the denial of evolution, is that they know that they're against evolution. So it really is, they're really defined by what they're against. And they're sort of able to tolerate each other even when they have mutually incompatible.
They're all in favor of intelligent design, certainly. And that's really the big umbrella that they all hide underneath.
Right. Although I hear rumors that there is some discontent, you know, between like young Earth creationists and those who believe that some evolution happens, but that God directed it. That, you know, so I don't know if this creationism alliance is going to hold, as it were. But certainly, whenever the battle becomes about teaching evolution or about evolution itself, they put aside their differences. They seem to and agree that their primary goal is attacking evolution.
I think if more of the creationists actually took the trouble to really consider which brand of creationism they believe in, I think you'd have a lot less problem with teaching evolution in the schools. When you ask them the question, did Adam and Eve have belly buttons? You know, most people are going to assume, well, sure, why wouldn't they? Yeah. Well, according to, you know, Genesis, they wouldn't, but according to evolution, they would.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're just talking, when you said there were seven forms of creationism, you were sticking within Judeo-Christianity?
Yes, I did, and I was only picking seven. I know that there's certainly many flavors and variations.
Right, right. And you can, if you go beyond Judeo-Christian religion, then there's many, many more types of creation. So Michael Shermer does this frequently. He says, okay, we're going to teach creationism. Should we teach, you know, then he gives examples of like Indian creationism or Inuit
turtles all the way down.
Turtles all the way down. People are like, no, we can't teach that. Well, you know, now you're discriminating based upon religion, you know. So that is kind of, I think, an effective tactic to take against it. Rather than just fighting their game of constantly being on the defensive about evolution, saying, well, what do you believe?
And then, of course, there's the creation myth that it was just a bunch of pasta thrown into the pot.
Hey, that's no myth. Okay, that's right. That's fact.
The Pastafarians, the flying
spaghetti. That's right. There's proof for that, though.
Now, in your podcast, do you ever directly take on purely religious belief systems?
I try not to. I think clearly whenever you talk about these Christian issues, my most popular episode is the Evolution Primer for Creationists. The second most popular is Religion as a Moral Center. The third most popular is Killing Faith, Deconstructionist Christians. It's just a common theme. Mm-hmm. I can't really avoid it. You have to talk about these because obviously that's what the listeners want to hear more of. And as much as I talk about, well, trying to be non-confrontational and trying to be accepting and welcoming and respectful, you just can't avoid it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I hear that from like the Skeptical Inquirer guys too. They say they always put out one issue a year or whatever that has Jesus on the cover, and it outsells all their other issues by a huge margin. Even within, you know, science and skeptical magazines and shows, the religious issues definitely have the draw,
for better or for worse.
Right, right, and of course they also tend to be the most contentious. I mean, do you get? How much hate mail do you get?
I don't get a tremendous amount of hate mail because I provide so many other outlets for them to communicate. I get
hate phone calls?
Hate phone calls. No, just rocks coming in through the window.
Hate smoke signals?
Those are particularly stinky. certainly, I get the most comments on the website on those. And, you know, some of these episodes have 250 comments. And it's usually a couple of people going back and forth arguing over, you know, does God exist, yes or no? Which is a very fruitful and useful argument these days.
So, Brian, you told me before the show that you have a bit of news to announce.
Yes, I do. Would you like me to announce it now?
No.
I would like you to announce it
well,
now.
This is actually a casting call, basically. I am a co-executive producer of a new TV show. It's called The Skeptologists. And think of it as Queer Eye for the Straight Guy meets Bullshit. Basically, we've got the team of experts, the team of skeptical experts. They see the bat signal, they jump in the Batmobile, and they go off racing to the center of the woo to work their skeptical magic on whatever the show's topic is for the week. The other executive producer is Ryan Johnson. He produces American Dragster on ESPN. The idea is we're going to be producing a first pilot episode, which his production company is then going to take and go out and sell. This is not a TV show that's already on the air or that's a done deal. I mean, let me be clear about that. This is very early stage. But we're going to be shooting the pilot the first quarter of this year, and then he's going to be taking it out and going out to sell. So what we're doing now is a casting call. We are basically looking for people to be these experts. The success of the show is very much dependent upon these great personalities who are going to be these skeptical experts. And we're looking for a medical doctor, an electrical engineer, a magician or illusionist, a physicist, and a psychologist. So
that's
we're looking.
Cool.
Here's the rules. They've got to be great personalities who are, you know, wonderful on TV and hilarious and incredibly awesome to look at. They've got to be obviously of a skeptical mindset. They've got to be willing to work for free and or at their own expense. The way these TV shows work, there really is no extra budget for paying talent until the show is actually picked up. And they've got to be in the LA area or willing to travel there and probably at their own expense. So within those parameters, we're welcoming inquiries from anyone who wants to be a personality on the TV show. It's a great opportunity. It costs you nothing. And if it gets picked up, great. You're a TV star. If it doesn't, hey, at least it was a lot of fun. So if anyone is interested in doing this, come to the skeptoid.com website and just click on Skeptologists. So that's skeptoid.com. That's my website for the podcast. And we've got a link on there for Skeptologists that's going to take you to the website that we're building for the show.
Wow. Oh, that's very cool.
Wow, that sounds like awesome. Sounds like a great project. So if I understand correctly then, so you're going to create a pilot essentially on spec and then try to shop it around?
That's the way that he works, yes. Ryan Johnson, the other producer.
Do you have anybody lined up yet, or are you starting from scratch with the casting call?
No, we're absolutely brand new. We're starting from scratch with the casting call now, and we've got about 2 months to get that worked out.
Cool. I hope some of our listeners take advantage of that. That'd be a great opportunity.
I hope so, too.
And you said this is based in the L.A. area, so you're at the other end of the country from where we are.
Yeah, the production all has to happen out here, and so that's basically, I mean, unless someone wants to travel at their own expense as often as necessary.
Yeah, so that was my next question. So how long do you foresee the production taking? Is it the kind of thing where somebody could come out there for a week and get it all done, or would they be going back and forth all the time?
Probably. It's probably going to be relatively quick. You know, this has to be something that's shot out of pocket to create the pilot, and so it's going to have a really compressed shooting schedule. But of course, first we've got to have casting meetings. We've got to, you know, we're going to get, we hope to get 4 or 5 of each of these people from which to choose. So we need to meet with these people and see how good they are on camera, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, would you work on the script once you have all these people together so that they can contribute, or do you have something of a working script done or in mind for the pilot episode?
The concept is fairly well nailed down, but as far as the actual subject matter of the pilot episode, no, that's not worked out yet. That's still the work in progress.
Okay, wow, you definitely have to keep us updated on that. That sounds...
I sure will. Hopefully we'll have lots of interesting updates.
I'll put that on my TiVo wish list, definitely.
Yeah, put it on there now.
So that sounds like a pretty significant project. I was going to ask you if you were planning on branching out from the Skeptoid podcast, but it sounds like that's your big project, at least for now.
At least for now. I mean, you know, the Skeptoid podcast is something that I really love doing, but I'd also love to see where it can possibly take me. You know, who knows?
Yeah, right. It's kind of where we are, too. I mean, we have a good base with the podcast, and we're constantly thinking of ways in which we can branch out, maybe even, you know, develop entirely new ways of getting the word out, or, you know, leveraging, you know, the audience that we've built up with the podcast.
Bob, I know you did that centerfold. I mean, you guys have been branching out a little bit.
It was sexy.
Yeah. Centerfold.
Of course, Rebecca, you've got your radio show.
I do, yeah. And the centerfold, of course. It's not nearly as sexy as Bob's, but what are you gonna do?
What? That's not on the internet, is it? I didn't put it out there.
My centerfold or yours?
Damn, no, mine.
No, yours is under my bed, right where I always keep it.
Awesome.
Okay, well, Brian, thanks for breaking that news on the Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you for providing a forum.
We look forward to more episodes of Skeptoid, and certainly hopefully that project will come to fruition. What are some upcoming episodes we should look out for?
Oh, some upcoming episodes. Let me open up my folder and I'll tell you. Magic jewelry, of course, the Q-ray and things like that. Reverse speech. Yeah. I've got another listener feedback episode coming up. I got one on super fruit juice, all of the super duper antioxidants and everything. And for some reason, people have been asking me to do an episode on The Secret for just the longest time. And I'm like, oh, that's so old. Everyone wants it.
With The Secret?
Yeah.
You got to give the people what they want, I guess.
Maybe they hope that if they just wish hard enough, it'll happen. You'll do an episode on The Secret.
So that means
that was very clever.
You have to prove it wrong and not
Thank
do it
you.
Now.
Oh, hey, I got to mention my book. I got to mention my book. My book is
on
Amazon.com. The book, Skeptoid, the same name as the podcast, Critical Analysis of Pop Phenomena. It's out now. It's available on Amazon.com. And the big news is that the foreword is by James Randi.
Awesome.
It was generous of him. He wrote a terrific foreword for the book. He's a very generous gentleman. And that's largely responsible for the success of the book so far, I'm sure.
The book covers the I think you said the first 50 episodes of Skeptoid, basically the same topics.
Yeah, it's an adaptation of the first 50 episodes. Each episode's a little chapter. So hopefully, I'd love to do one book for each 50 episodes going forward.
And you already have the audiobook version recorded, so that's pretty easy.
I do. That was easy.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining us on The Skeptic's Guide.
Thanks, Brian.
Well, thank you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. And I challenge my expert skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Are you guys ready for this week's items?
Yes.
No.
All right.
Yes. Herr Kommandant.
Here we go. Item number one. New research shows that some over-the-counter dietary supplements may promote the progression of prostate cancer. Item number two. New evidence shows that humans have better hearing in terms of frequency discrimination than almost all other animals. And item number three. The bubonic plague has recently reached epidemic levels in parts of Africa and Asia, and experts warn of a possible worldwide pandemic if immediate steps are not taken. Rebecca, please go first this week.
Oh, man.
Come on, Rebecca.
Okay. I can do this. Over-the-counter dietary supplements promoting prostate cancer. That makes sense. Dietary supplements are universally pretty much bad for you. So, that's fine. New evidence that humans have better hearing than animals, but in terms of frequency discrimination, I wouldn't buy it except for that frequency discrimination thing, which makes me pause. So that might be fiction. The bubonic plague has reached epidemic levels in Africa and Asia. That's gotta be fiction. I haven't heard anything about that, and I'm going to say that's fiction. That seems like the sort of thing that might make the news. So, yes.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, I mean, I hate this one. These ones that are just way too obvious. One I could buy that. That seems, you know, these over the counter supplements. Who knows what the hell is going in there? Especially they can have some nasty interactions with other medications. Number two, I'm totally buying that. Number three, what the hell? Bubonic plague in Africa, and it could be a pandemic immediately. We need to take immediate steps. What the hell? I've been through tons of science sites in the past 2 days. I think that would have been at the top. So I have to say that's fiction, but I don't know why you would do something so blatantly obvious. So you're screwing us one way or the other. Let's see, shall we?
So much bitterness.
Okay, Jay.
I have to kind of agree. I would assume that at least one of us would have heard it if the bubonic plague is hitting hard in Africa. I don't know, Steve. But there it is, you know. This is how Steve's crafty with these things. The over-the-counter dietary supplements, I would never doubt that taking something wacky, there's something out there that's bad that could promote prostate cancer. Sure. I mean, that's very plausible. Humans have better hearing in terms of frequency discrimination than almost all other animals. I don't know, though. There's something about that that I don't buy either, but I'm sure there's a weird little wrinkle in there that explains that away. I'm going to have to agree with Rebecca and Bob and go with the bubonic plague as the fake. Okay, Evan?
Yeah, I guess I have to follow the other buffalo over the cliff and
lemming.
Bubonic plague.
You know, lemmings don't actually
fiction.
Run over cliffs.
Yeah, you're right. They don't. I don't know how that even started. How did that start?
I do.
That stupid myth. How?
From a Disney documentary. Possibly.
Oh, I love Disney.
Yeah, but in this case, they may have fudged something that made it look like something was happening that wasn't actually happening. Long story. Let's get back to science or fiction.
Well, no, the next thing you're going to tell me is that eating an apple won't put you to sleep. So.
What?
But mammoths do run over cliffs when they're being chased by Neanderthals.
Well,
with
duh.
Spears. Okay, let's take these in order.
Tom Cruise would know.
Master of the mind.
New research shows that some over-the-counter dietary supplements may promote the progression of prostate cancer. Of course it does.
Of course.
This one is, of course, science.
Pure science.
So this study showed that these findings were published in Clinical Cancer Research, and it reaffirms that patients need to tell their doctors what dietary supplements they're taking. Unfortunately, a lot of patients don't think they have to because they're just supplements, right? Which is, you know, why I'm most critical of the way they are regulated in many countries, especially the United States, because people think that supplements are things like vitamins and minerals, when in fact, a lot of herbal remedies are drugs. And a lot of these herbal supplements contained estrogen and testosterone in it. You know, those are drugs, folks. Those are hormones. And if you have prostate cancer, taking testosterone is not a good thing. That can, you know, cause the cancer to become more aggressive. This was first realized when a doctor saw a couple of cases of patients taking the same dietary supplement. Suddenly, you know, their prostate cancer became of a much more aggressive type. And this, you know, they backtracked and found out that, you know, this supplement had testosterone in it. So that one is science. So the bottom line is treat supplements as drugs and tell your doctors when you're taking them. The second one, new evidence shows that humans have better hearing in terms of frequency discrimination than almost all other animals. And that one is also science.
Yay!
Explain that. The buffalo win.
Interesting.
Go humans.
That's very interesting. It was a surprising result. We're used to thinking of animals as having superior hearing to humans. And of course, many animals have greater sensitivity in terms of hearing softer sounds. They may have a greater range of frequency that they could hear. And they may have better directional hearing, especially animals that have, like, you know, big ears, like deer. You know, they could turn that ear in one direction. But what this study showed, and this was a study looking at the response of neurons in the auditory cortex to different frequencies. And what this showed is that humans have superior ability to discriminate even tiny differences in the frequency of sounds that are being heard. Even a single neuron can discriminate these tiny differences in frequency. The study was actually very innovative. This is being published in this week's journal Nature. This was done by Dr. Fried, who is a professor of neurosurgery and director of the Epilepsy Surgery Program, and his colleagues at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And what they did was, so with patients who are being evaluated to see whether or not they will benefit and they can tolerate getting surgery to treat their epilepsy, basically cut out the part of the brain that's generating all the seizures, they need to have monitoring of the electrical activity of their brain with implanted electrodes. So they said, hey, we could use the opportunity to do some recordings while we're doing the prep for the epilepsy surgery. Because normally you wouldn't implant electrodes into humans' brains just to study what's going on. So that was clever. And this is the result. They were able to, you know, use these those patients who needed to have electrodes placed in this part of the brain anyway, and they did this study, and what they found is that the human auditory system could discriminate these very tiny differences in frequency.
But this is studied at the neuron level, though. I mean, did they?
Yeah, at the neuron level. Yeah.
Yeah, but can you translate that into like putting headphones on somebody and determining the same results that way? Or is this something that doesn't translate into something,
No, it probably would. It probably would translate, and you could do that follow-up study in people. Of course, it would be very difficult to do that in animals,
right,
so it would be hard
right.
to make the comparison.
Okay. So
the,
for apples to
animals,
apples, this is better.
Which is why this is interesting. Yeah, that's why this is interesting in terms of comparing humans to animals. But it would be interesting to see if humans can perceive such subtle differences. What makes sense about this, if we try to make sense
language.
Of the implications of this research, is that, you know, is language. Yeah, people evolved to discriminate even very subtle differences in language. And that, you know, as our brains evolved over the last, you know, million years or so, we probably started talking about 2 million years or so ago with Homo erectus, just based upon the anatomy of their hyoid bone. So, you know, we've had a couple million years to evolve our brain, our auditory cortex, to fine-tune it to speech. So it makes sense that we would have very fine discrimination. The only animal they mentioned that actually has better frequency discrimination
bats.
Than humans is bats, of course, because they evolved to use echolocation. So that makes perfect sense. Which means that, number three, the bubonic plague has recently reached epidemic levels in parts of Africa and Asia, and experts warn of a possible worldwide pandemic if immediate steps are not taken.
It's like you're not even trying.
You guys.
Or it's a 500-year-old article.
Wait, you want to be so
now
obvious.
Now listen, let me give you the backstory on this. I had to make it, you know, wrong enough that nobody would complain. Sometimes the obvious one is the right answer. I have to mix it up a little bit. Now, the bubonic plague, which is a bacterial infection that is caused by Yersinia pestis and can travel from rodents.
What is that?
It's
not extinct, right?
It's not extinct. Humans. That's the bubonic plague. The same. There are other strains that could be passed through the air, and that's called the pneumonic plague, but it's the same basic bacteria, different strains. It still exists in Asia and Africa, and it has been making a resurgence in Africa, although it's not at epidemic levels, and no one's talking about a pandemic. That's the part that I made up. But it's still around, and it is a problem in Asia and Africa, and there was some recent news items about it, so that's why I thought I might have caught somebody who read the title and didn't read the article.
Steve, you said it was passed to us with what? What mechanism?
It's passed from person to person just through breathing, you know, just through air, like air droplets, like any airborne infection. That's the pneumonic plague. Bubonic is from rodent to human.
Imagine you go to your doctor, and the doctor's like, "Hey, dude, you have bubonic plague.
The
rodent
black plague."
Oh, how do they treat that?
Cheese and mousetraps.
With antibiotics.
Bring out your dead.
Yeah, now in the 1300s, this wiped out a lot of Europe. Although, interestingly, as I was reading some background for this piece, a couple of years ago, there was an article published and that was casting doubt on whether or not the Black Plague, you know, of Europe of the 1300s was, in fact, the bubonic plague.
No way,
it may
really
not have been. That determination really was only made in the 1800s. They figured that the plague was the bubonic plague because the symptoms were very similar. But a lot of the symptoms are nonspecific and could be due to a lot of different infections. So it's really not clear what the infection was. In fact, what they argued was there were some records that showed that the spread of the plague was too rapid for a disease that was spread by rodents, and it was probably something that was spread by direct human-to-human contact. They also said that there were not records of, you know, the streets being carpeted with dead rats, which is usually what happens in the midst of one of these plagues, so that therefore it may have been a different bacteria than what we now call the bubonic plague. But this is still controversial, and by complete coincidence, Tara Smith over at Etiology has been writing a multi-part blog on this very question. So for more information, I defer to the Tara Smith's Etiology blog.
That was a bad way to go, too. What a horrible death.
It was. Yeah, it was.
The black pustules all over you, your tongue swells.
If only Scientology was around then, they could have helped all those people. But
yeah.
Oh, well.
If only.
Just,
if only.
You know, just when you think you know what wiped out 75% of Europe, bam. Crap.
Yeah, I mean, I think the final word has yet to come on that. I do remember reading something about somebody looking for some forensic evidence of what
might have
caused
it. Yeah, I was just thinking about that. Somebody that might have, I don't know. I remember reading for the the pandemic in the 19-teens, was it 19 during World War One, the Spanish flu, it was called. I remember they found some frozen bodies in like in the North Pole or something. Somebody that had traveled up there with that flu, and they were actually able. The preservation was so well that they were able to get some of the virus from the flu, and they actually have it.
Put it in a jar.
Have it in their little deep research labs and stuff. So I was wondering, I was trying to think of how somebody could have been, you know, preserved from back then, but not very likely.
So congratulations, everyone. Well done. I didn't sucker you in with that one. Jay, can you please close out our show with a quote?
This is a quote from Marie Curie. Did I say that right?
Yep.
Why do they always hear Madame Curie?
They're both correct.
Marie Curie was born in 1867. She died coincidentally on July 4th, 1934. She was a physicist and a chemist. She was also considered a pioneer in the field of radioactivity, and I didn't know that at all. Just found that out.
She died of radiation poisoning. She was glowing in her coffin.
Oh, you know what? I do remember something along those lines. Anyway, she was the first person to be twice honored with a Nobel Prize, and I think she was the only one to get it in two different sciences.
Oh, wow.
She was also the first female professor at the University of Paris. And her quote is, "I am among those who think that science has great beauty. A scientist in his laboratory is not only a technician, he is also a child placed before natural phenomena which impress him like a fairy tale." Marie Curie!
Does it always make me laugh?
You're lucky I found that for you, Jay.
Sure, easy.
You know why that always makes me laugh? Because it's always like 11 at night. We're at the end of the podcast.
Anything will make you laugh.
Well,
anything.
You're happy that it's all over, Rebecca.
I think I am. Yeah.
Well, thank you all for joining me once
again.
You're
welcome.
A pleasure as always.
Steve, you're a kick-ass scientist. I'd like to thank everyone who responded to my request for web help. I'd still like to welcome more people. If anyone's interested, you could just email us. The people that I did respond to, I will be responding again soon. I'm going to put together a plan of action now. So hopefully within the next week or so, you should be getting another email from me. And things are progressing.
Yeah, and very soon we will have our website makeover.
And our new logo.
A couple of other quick announcements. Rebecca Watson was just interviewed for the latest episode of The Infidel Guy, so check that out at infidelguy.com. And I was also recently interviewed by Ginger Campbell for an episode of Books and Ideas about neurology primarily. So again, check that out. We'll have those links. And 5x5, our new podcast, is finally up on iTunes, so check that out as well. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and Skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.